Hi everybody, this is Joanne from Read Science and I'm here with my co-host Jeff, and we like to get together on occasion with a popular science author to talk about how they communicate science in engaging and compelling ways and in understandable ways to the general public. Today, I am very, very excited to have as our guest the magnificent Steve Silberman, who has written, well, he caught my eye with his Wired article many, many years ago. I have one daughter on the autistic spectrum, and so this article caught my eye, and ever since I've sort of been keeping an eye on what he does. So, he's written a magnificent book. It's on the New York Times bestseller list. It's called NeuroTribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. And it is most certainly a book that I wish I had 16 years ago when my daughter was first diagnosed, because I had to learn everything bit by bit, gather things on the internet, talk to other moms, all this stuff. And this book does all that and more. So I wish I had it, and it was interesting to read it from my perspective of going, oh yeah, I know about those vitamins. I wanted to try those, or how about this? And then I was cautioned, anybody will take your money. So, you know, then I thought more wisely of some of the ideas out there. So I do want to introduce you all to Steve Silberman, and luckily he has a lovely bio on his website that you can visit at stevesilberman.com. Steve is an award-winning science writer whose articles have appeared in all the places that our guests have articles, Wired, The New Yorker, MIT Technology Review, Nature, Salon, Shambhala Sun, okay, that's a new one,
that's
and
a new
many
one.
Other publications. He is the author of the book that I told you about, NeuroTribes, and the foreword of this book is written by his friend Oliver Sacks. What a wonderful person to have as your friend. So he also has a TED Talk called The Forgotten History of Autism, and that is most certainly a highlight of this book. So he has won unexpected, he has won many journalism awards, including the 2010 Science Journalism Award for magazine writing for something called The Placebo Problem, and that was from the AAAS, Kavli Foundation Reward. It was also featured on Colbert Report, which is coveted but no longer possible anymore. So his writing on science, culture, and literature has been collected in a number of major anthologies, including the Best American Science Writing of the Year and Best Business Stories of the Year. And you can find Steve on Twitter at Steve Silberman. All right, Steve, welcome so much. We are so glad you are here.
Thank you, Joanne, and hi, Jeff. And it's really an honor to be here.
It's really true. I am delighted, and I'm even happy to report that I got to the very last page of the text at about 10 after 1 this morning.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But that's
yes. How many times does Jeff apologize for, I've almost finished your book?
it happens sometimes, but I had a day off yesterday and a delightful time reading it, and I don't see why people can't enjoy reading it 10 pages at a time at bedtime, but let me tell you, it also works if you read the whole thing in 2 days.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
I remember I read
Rebecca Skloot's The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks in one single cross-country flight, and it was one of those thrilling cross-country flights I ever had, and when I got off the plane, I was reading an advanced reading copy. And when I got off the plane, I was like babbling to the person in the Newark Airport bookstore, this is going to be a bestseller, you know. And of course it was.
Yeah, it's true. You know, it was, and I'll tell you, you know how engaging that book is. Not to bring people down, but my dad was in hospice, and I was still able to concentrate on this book.
Wow.
You know, that's how good her book was, and I had
an
advanced reader copy. But anyway, magnificent. It's always great when you get a book that you can sit and read.
Yeah. I would say models, but that makes it seem like I got anywhere close. But my two big aspirational models for my book were Rebecca Skloot's book for the sheer excitement of reading while learning about the science around Henrietta Lacks. And also, Siddhartha Mukherjee wrote a fantastic book called The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. And that was very much an inspiration for NeuroTribes.
Wow. So, Jeff, this is where you say, by the way, Joanne.
By the way. But there were
Joanne
so many things.
Always talks about Emperor of All Maladies. Every chance I get.
I finally got a copy of it. So as soon as I stop reading all these excellent books that we're talking to people about, I will have some time and I will read that book because we've been having the most interesting conversations about cancer in this series. But tonight we're going to talk about autism and your book. There is the Emperor of All Maladies.
I think I just carry a copy on my hip all the time. No, I'm joking.
It's very good.
It's so good.
But you know, those are excellent models to be working from, and I don't mind saying I think you've done an excellent job, and people can learn from you. And that leaves me with so many things swirling around in my head, especially since I read most of them in the last 24 hours. I was trying to do my duty of thinking of the place to start the conversation. And I have one, but there's so many. We'll get to them. But anyway, I was reading, I was on page 329, and I was reading about, Rimland's experiments, in quotation marks, with the vitamins, and that he claimed to have, quote, analyzed, remember that I'm a physicist, using what he called, quote, computer clustering. And it all struck me as much more pseudoscientific double talk than even a Star Trek episode. And that put me in mind of Richard Feynman, who pointed out to us that science is the best way we know of trying not to fool yourself, but you have to be careful because you're the easiest person to fool. And I think that's what was going on. And then I thought, because we want to talk about communicating science, which your book does very well, I decided maybe that one theme for this book that we could start with is the motto, science is hard. And if the history of autism tells us anything, and there are many things, it certainly tells us that getting the science right is a hard thing, isn't it? There have been a lot of troubles trying to figure out what's going on, and what a misery it seems sometimes. This is an open-ended essay question. I don't really know where to start.
Well, yeah. I mean, in a sense, it's, my book is like a history of generally very well-intentioned people getting things wrong. And then, you know, their theories, they generate theories. Their theories are superseded. You know, I was recently writing a piece for the BBC that will hopefully run next week, where I say something like the history of autism is a history of myths. And, you know, it basically one myth after another has been generated to sort of explain autistic people. And some of the myths have been completely ridiculous and off base, like the one that Donald Trump repeated at the GOP debate last night about a kid becoming autistic 2 days after receiving a vaccine. And some of the myths have been rather more close to the truth, like the fact that Hans Asperger believed that that some of the kids in his clinic could make good code breakers. And in fact, if you know anything about the history of Alan Turing and World War II and Bletchley Park, people with autistic traits were probably working at Bletchley Park breaking the German Enigma code. So Asperger was probably right about that. I basically start before the beginning of autism research because I was trying to solve a problem in science communication. And do you mind if I say what I think that problem was?
No, and I think this relates to another question, but I'm thinking I know. Let's see if I'm right. Go ahead.
Well, what happened was I wrote an article in 2001 called The Geek Syndrome that Joanne referred to about autism in Silicon Valley and in high-tech communities more generally. And it came out of an experience of being on a boat in Alaska with 100 computer programmers and figuring out that a lot of families in Silicon Valley that were very adept at technology seemed to have autistic children in them. And so I tell the whole story in the introduction of the book. So I wrote this article called The Geek Syndrome, and it made kind of a splash, and it was one of the first articles to address the notion that there were a lot of people with autistic traits in high-tech communities, which is now practically a pop culture cliche. But at the time, it wasn't yet, or it was just becoming one. Mm-hmm. And what was unusual about that article was that I kept getting email about it for like 10 years. And anybody who's a magazine journalist knows that to get email about a magazine article for 10 years is very unusual. Yeah. But most of the emails that I got were not about what caused my child's autism, which is what the whole world was having a very heated argument about during that 10-year period. Virtually every comment section on the internet was dominated by arguments between people who were absolutely passionately believed that vaccines had made their children autistic, mm-hmm. and people who said that that was not true. And then the people who believed it would claim that the people who didn't believe it were shills for Big Pharma. That was sort of the classic phrase. And, you know, we can laugh, but here's the thing. It's like, I know a lot of people who like to think that the people who believe that vaccines cause autism, particularly 10 years ago or whatever, were just deniers and they didn't know anything and they were not science-savvy people. That was completely not true. In fact, many of the people who particularly back then, believed that vaccines cause autism, actually read, you know, virtually every paper and, you know, were scouring the internet for clues about what had happened to their kids. But the problem was that the vaccines cause autism narrative had rushed into a vacuum to explain something that had never been explained adequately to parents and to the lay public. And that is, why did the number of diagnoses and the mm-hmm. estimates of autism prevalence spike so dramatically in the 1990s? And, you know, if you talk to somebody down at the CDC, they would say, well, it's better case finding and broadened diagnostic criteria, you know. And so you have, like, you know, if you're a newspaper guy, you have, like, this guy in a suit saying, it's broadened diagnostic criteria and better case finding. And then, you know, the next person you interview is a mom who's saying, like, I just want to keep my children safe, mm-hmm. you know. So it's like, whose narrative is going to really connect with readers or viewers? And not only that, but journalists are trained, thank God, to often sympathize with the underdog. And so you have, you know, on the one side you have Big Pharma and the CDC. They're certainly not the underdogs. On the other side you have warrior moms who are trying to defend the safety of their children. Yeah. So,
well, who will do anything to try to help their kids? And I think you introduced us to some of these people, and I think the motivations are very easy to understand. And, you know, that's what we want. That's what you want to accomplish, right, is to show us, even if the facts are wrong, this is a very easy path to go down if you understand what's happening.
Right, right. And so what I felt, I felt basically a huge disconnect as a science journalist between what the experts, who really were experts, I'm talking about people like Lorna Wing, who invented the concept of the autism spectrum, what she felt about why the diagnoses were going up versus what, you know, the man or woman on the street felt was the reason why the diagnoses were going up. And even now, you know, I mean, I live in San Francisco. It's considered to be, you know, fairly, you know, liberal and sophisticated and even science-savvy, you know, community. But even now, it's like when I tell people that I just published a book on autism, they'll say, oh, that's great. And then they'll lean close to me and they'll say, it's the vaccines, isn't it? Or it's the pesticides, isn't it? Or right. It's the GMOs, isn't it? You know?
Right.
And so it's like everybody has their pet theory. And so I felt that something had gone off track in autism history. And so I sort of kept digging farther and farther back to figure out where it went wrong. And I ended up figuring out that much to my surprise, really, that the basic timeline of autism's discovery mm-hmm. as it's reiterated in thousands of textbooks that are on shelves all over University of Illinois, I'm sure, Wikipedia, you know, that was wrong, that it was incorrect, that the basic timeline of autism's discovery was wrong, and that if eventually, I mean, it took me more than a year, but I mean, just to figure out this piece of the book, but I figured out that once you knew the true timeline of autism's discovery, the dramatically spiking numbers in the 90s made much more sense. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of the arc that I tell in the book.
There are several communications questions I hope that I get to, but the one mm-hmm. that seemed to come next for me to get us still started is what it seemed to me when you were doing your research, I wondered what sequence of references, what threads that you were reading led you to decide to start with the story of Henry Cavendish, which was a great place to start. It draws in so many things and leads you off in so many ways. But how did that happen?
That's actually a fascinating question that no one has ever asked me before. So
we're all for scientists and science here on Read Science.
Great. Well, my answer will be very revealing, actually. What happened was, early on in my research, I made an excellent decision, which was to accept an invitation to go to an event called Autreat, which was an autistic retreat run by and for autistic people. So for several days, I was one of the only neurotypical, you know, i.e. non-autistic, people at this gathering with about 70 autistic adults and kids. Mm-hmm. And they were at all levels of functioning and, you know, I mean, I don't peg people by functioning levels anyway because they can change from day to day. But, you know, some people were nonverbal. Some were, in fact, unbelievably verbal. You know, some people were, you know, obviously quite disabled, and while others could probably pass for neurotypical. However, several things became clear. One was that, for one thing, I had a great time at Autry. It was really wonderful, and for some unexpected reasons. For one thing, I have rarely been in an environment that was more BS-free, you could say. Like, people were not spinning or trying to impress each other or, you know, working angles with each other, trying to manage their own reputations and blah, blah, blah. It was like people were just themselves, just very, very blunt. And I remember, in fact, a kind of hilarious story. I was having lunch at Autreat, and there was a young woman sitting at the table, and I was talking with someone else, and I was explaining that I'm married to a man, etc. And so this girl was not saying anything. So I assumed that she was nonverbal, but nonverbal doesn't mean not listening. So I thought she was probably listening, but she didn't say anything, so I figured she was nonverbal, which was fine. There were lots of nonverbal people there. So later on, I was walking down the hall, and she comes down the hall, and she said, I really enjoyed listening to your conversation at lunch. You're kind of like my dad, except for the whole gay thing. These people just are not holding anything back. Like, they speak their minds, you know? And it was wonderful, and, you know, I'm kind of a big, goofy-looking guy, but nobody cared, you know. It's like I didn't have to be glamorous, you know, when I was there. So it was a very liberating environment for me, even though I'm not autistic. And for autistic people, it was an incredibly liberating environment. So I come back from Autry, and I set about writing my book. And so I was originally going to start with maybe Leo Kanner and Hans Asperger, the people who were originally credited for discovering autism. Particularly Kanner is usually given the credit, but I figured out that it was Asperger who really discovered it. But so I start describing autistic people, and I'm using the descriptions that, you know, everyone uses, and, you know, laying out the deficits and impairments that, you know, define autism and autistic people. And at some point I was sort of like, What am I doing? Like, this is all like inherited language. It's for one thing, it's stale. For another thing, it's not even really true. Like, I was just with a bunch of autistic people. They were not like this, you know, or at least they were not. They were not as limited as these descriptions are, you know. And, for instance, there was another moment at Autry when someone who was there had just been appointed to the National Council on Disability by President Obama. His name is Ari Niemann. He's the he was the founder of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, which is a wonderful organization. Anyway, so Ari was introduced to the crowd, and they don't applaud at Autry because it creates this loud, shocking burst of sensory overstimulation. They flappause, which is to hold their hands up and flap, which is wonderful because it it's very exuberant, and it turns a very stigmatized symptom of autism into a sign of celebration, which is wonderful. So
it's
so
anyway, what so deaf people do too.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Yeah. Oh, that's great.
This
yeah.
is the way you so-called applause. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. I wonder if autistic people got it from deaf people.
I think it might be convergent.
Yeah, that's interesting. Anyway,
or
so
borrowed.
Yeah, that's interesting. So they introduce Ari, and there's everyone flat pauses, and then in the back, this young girl said, "We love you, Ari. If we were capable of feeling such an emotion." So it was like that was the moment that I realized that autistic people do not understand humor and are unable to appreciate sarcasm. That's completely wrong. You know, it was like they were some of the funniest people I'd ever met, really.
Yeah, that's totally wrong.
So I found that basically all the language that was stored up in my head from reading, you know, million autism books was wrong.
Right.
And so I had to come up with fresh language to describe the way autistic people behave. And I don't mean autistic people as a mass. Mm-hmm. I mean individual autistic people. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me that if I started by describing an autistic person who was alive before all the clinical cliches sort of sedimentalized, you know, like set around them, that I could describe them in fresh language as if no one had ever seen an autistic person before.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, the thing about Henry Cavendish is that he was not only an amazing scientist, and the word scientist doesn't even do him justice, he didn't just do science, he invented whole fields of science.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he was very autistic. It wasn't like he was, he's kind of geeky and a touch of the spectrum, you know. He was quite disabled. If he was in public gatherings, which, by the way, he liked to go to, but he would hang out off to the side looking down. He hated to make eye contact. His voice was described as sort of really odd, you know. And he ate the same dish at nearly every meal for his entire adult life, leg of mutton. He wore the same outfit for decades. When it would wear out, he would have his tailor make an identical outfit. He took the same walk at night along the same route every night at the same time. So he was quite routinized, one might say. And he carried that rigor and systematizing mind into his experiments as well. And he ended up being... measuring the density of the earth in a shed in his backyard and coming really close to the true number. In fact, his number was the best estimate for about 100 years. So anyway, the wonderful thing about Henry Cavendish is because he was so bright and because he was so enmeshed in this community of people in the Royal Society, this greatest scientist of their age, like Humphrey Davy, there were a lot of contemporary accounts of his behavior which his peers found absolutely inexplicable.
Yeah.
So it was like they all respected him greatly because he was obviously a genius. They all liked him actually very much, but they could not help but notice that his behavior was extremely eccentric and he had fascinating peculiarities. And extraordinary singularities was another phrase.
Right.
I loved how you described how one of his colleagues or contemporaries said, so if you want to talk to him, don't look at him.
Right.
He said, look off into space, you know, look off to the side. And I was like, boy, do I know many people on the spectrum that's true for.
Oh, I know. And, you know, that's actually like one of the, you know, one of the myths, you know, that of autism was that they don't like to make eye contact. And, you know, many of the early, particularly psychotherapists who noted that, saw it as an aggressive way of shutting out, you know, people, and they don't like people, and they don't even like their own parents, and they're shutting them out, and, you know, perhaps they've been traumatized by bad parenting, you know, so it's like there was all this BS, you know. Actually, what is true is that autistic people often find it easier to pay close attention to what someone is saying by looking off to the side, by taking in the world slant-wise. And that's one of the things that Asperger figured out back in the 1930s and 40s. He said something like, you know, they don't look you in the eye, but they actually take in a surprising amount of information by looking at the world sideways. And So by talking about Cavendish, I was able to talk about an autistic person without being, you know, this layer of clinical...
Yes. Without the checklist. They need to have three from this category and five from this category.
Yep. Right. And, very close to this, I have one more Sal question, and Joanne knows that I do this. I say, really, I'll let her talk next. But, no, the Cavendish story was two things. It was engaging. Okay, it was three things. It was engaging. It was, you know, amusing, but also was very enlightening. And it told us in that one rather nice profile of him a lot about autistic people that went way beyond, like you said, went way beyond the standard things. And then the style question was, a lot of the book, more so in the first half, I think, or so, but an awful lot of it, you did sort of as almost set a group of case studies of different people. And that had the effect in my mental picture then was something like a watercolor that someone paints with washes and layers. You take all of these case studies and you put them together and you start to see through them what they have in common. And that gives us people that we can associate with and feel engaged with. But it also was very illuminating because you wove a lot of science into that in very accurate ways so that we started putting together our own picture from seeing all those patterns. And I was going to say something, you know, ridiculous like, and so I guess you chose to do that. Why? But
that's
whether
right,
you
though.
Did or not,
it
worked very well.
Yeah, it's true. And it also reflects my own learning process. Because as I put those case studies together, and case studies, it's a very good description, because I was actually trying to do something quite subversive, which is that most case studies are, you know, like at you know, like the ideal, like sort of late 20th century case studies were written by Oliver Sacks, who was obviously, a mentor to me and a friend and also like a very much a model. But you know, all of his case studies are of patients. In a sense, I wrote case studies of the doctors, more or less.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like I'm writing a case study of Asperger, and I'm writing a case study of Connor. And so I was, in very subversive ways, trying to turn the medical lens toward the neurotypical people in the same way that the neurotypical people had been turning a medical lens on autistic people. The other thing that I don't really expect anyone to notice, but even in scenes where it's a patient being examined by the doctor, almost always those scenes are in, you know, other people's books, those scenes are written about at the patient's expense, like, you know, here the patient says something, they're clearly delusional, you know.
Yeah.
But I have several scenes in my book where if there's a patient and a doctor sitting in the room and I'm reporting what they said, it's actually the doctor who looks ridiculous.
Yeah.
So anyway,
I think
I mean, not that I'm trying to, you know, ridicule the medical profession or something.
No.
But I want, Yeah, and autistic people deserve props, basically, because we put them through bloody hell for decades. And so, you know, I wanted to tell the story not just from the third-person, white, male, privileged doc, you know. I wanted to subvert that structure in whatever ways I could.
The horrors, I wrote a note once, you know, the horrors that they went through at various times in different ways were astounding. But you don't need to recap those. Yeah. They're all in the book, and I promised Joanne I'd stop for a little bit.
Well, there were I will tell you, there were definitely parts of the book where I cried writing. Like when I was writing the last part of the Asperger chapter, which we needn't make any spoilers. But when I was writing the last part of the Asperger chapter, I was crying almost continuously. I was listening to there's a Jewish composer named Steve Reich who wrote he wrote a piece for Daniel Pearl, the journalist who was Wall Street Journal journalist who was beheaded by more or less ISIS, more or less. So Steve Reich wrote a gorgeous piece called The Daniel Variations, and it's kind of a update of Jewish sacred music in many ways. And I would, you know, put on the Daniel Variations and write the last part of the Asperger chapter. I was weeping for weeks on end, really, because it's the depth of tragedy and horror is so absolutely profound.
Right.
And
it's,
you know, the
very
thing
poignant.
Is, I'm sorry. Very poignant. And I'll shut up and just let me say one more thing about that. One of the main things about my book that I'm happy about is that how many books have been written about Asperger syndrome? Answer, many. You know, how many books have been written about Asperger? Well, not that many.
Not much.
And they're all in German. You know, there were basically, there was one description of Asperger's clinic in Uta Frith's classic book, Autism and Asperger Syndrome. Everybody's been cribbing off those two paragraphs more or less for, you know, 20 years. What occurred to me was like, hey, guys, Asperger was working during the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was working in a Nazi-occupied country during the Holocaust. What happens if, instead of fretting about what his descriptions of his patients were like or not like, what happens if you pull the camera back? What do you see? And what you see is the Holocaust. And you know, German eugenics programs. And you realize that Asperger must have been walking to work every morning, walking to the clinic, past burning Jewish storefronts, you know. And the fact that no one had ever examined the impact that that might have had on his work. You know, it's like we like to think, well, it's science, you know, that stuff, all politics, that's all going on outside the window. You know?
Oh, well.
No, you know, no. You know, I mean, homosexuality was in the DSM until the 70s, and what took
that
it out
whole
was
thing
politics.
About, what, life unworthy of life and all of that, and vivisection, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
That's why, just one of the reasons to say it was a horror. Sorry, Joanne, I stopped.
Sorry, and that's all I have to say, but I just wanted to make that point. Yeah.
That's so funny. Well, I might talk about my daughter in a little bit, but I do want to bring up something. So you have, Steve, written in the past about, or you've talked about, mentioned Tony Atwood. So when we talk about Asperger's, and we want to talk about someone who's an expert on Asperger's, Tony Atwood is a name that comes up. Just like when you say autism, we will mention Temple Grandin, because these are two people who have come in, helped educate tons and tons of parents.
Yeah.
Right. So I reached out at one point to Tony Atwood because I want to say 2010 there was a book written called "Don't Be Such a Scientist." Okay. Mm-hmm. And this book claimed that scientists should be more engaging with the public. They should be more theatrical and more sexy, even. You know what I mean? So people would like science and people would connect with science. And what I recall from one of the many conferences I went to on behalf of my daughter as I was trying to learn about autism, high-functioning autism in particular, was Tony Atwood saying, you get 0 points if you run into someone with Asperger's in a chemistry department, in a math department. That there are so many people who are very comfortable in a university setting. Because in science and math, you are allowed to focus on your one favorite thing, and you are rewarded for it. And, you know, and you, and for the most part, until recently, you could give pretty much a talk where you don't have to make eye contact. You don't have, you could just give your information, because we as scientists like to sit around and go, I don't need to be entertained. It's nice, but I don't need to be. I just want the information. You know, is your data good? Were your methods appropriate? Are you drawing a conclusion that, you know, we can get on board with? So, so I reached out to Tony Atwood to ask about this. Like, so, you know, do you think this is probably a good thing to be insisting scientists be this way if so many of them, this is not going to be their natural, way of relating to the world? And and he said, well, you know, to reiterate, he said, yeah, you know, they feel safe because they are focusing on what they want to focus on. They found their passion. And this is very common in autism, to have a passion or two that, you know, is a great thing to focus on, and where their gifts will come shining through. And you know, so I thought that was interesting to think, you know, maybe we shouldn't be expecting every scientist to be able to be the charismatic, you know, orator who can, you know, engage the general public, and maybe they should just do their work that they're very good at.
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because my whole deal with this book was that I felt that the true facts, you could say, of autism history had to be embedded in a compelling story, or else it would be too boring. That I wouldn't be able to just lay out, you know, the 20 inflection points in autism history when the perception of the diagnosis changed, you know, as a bulleted list, and change any minds. From my perspective, what changes minds are meaningful stories. What I ended up with is a 500-page book of anecdotes, and with data embedded in them. What's funny is that I've got, yes, it's a thick book with many, you know, footnotes at the end. But what's funny is that I've been very, very lucky and happy, because most of the reviews have been very positive. I did get one review on a blog, which I won't mention the name, but basically what the guy said, and he's someone who believes that he's on the spectrum, and what he said was something like, this is such a non-autistic book. It's like, blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, why doesn't he just give us the information? And,
facts, ma'am.
Right, exactly. I thought that was really interesting. And then, you know, I read a similar comment actually this morning. I think it was on Goodreads. It was like, this is 100 pages of information, you know, padded to a 500-page book, with all these bloody life stories. Who cares, you know? But the thing is that I believe me, I'm perseverating on, the couple of negative reviews I've gotten, because almost all of them have been positive. But the thing is that I felt that the people who most needed to learn the data that's in the book about why the diagnoses have been going up so much, many of them could be reached by a compelling human story,
right?
Even if, you know, that a bulleted list would not work with them, and that it would not change minds. And so, you know, I risked boring to death, you know, the readers who just tell me what, get bloody to it, you know, just get to the point, you know. I don't need to know what Asperger was like when he was a teenager. I don't need to know that he was into this goth poet named Grill Park. Who cares, you know? Like, but I'm fascinated by that stuff. Like, I love origin stories, as anyone who's plowed through my book can attest, you know? And so I love figuring out not just what decisions a clinician made, but what experiences in his or her life story before they made that decision contributed to that decision. I find that fascinating.
Yeah, well, your book was lovely. And I will now diverge and talk about my daughter a bit. She is actually, I would say, the most literary of my children. She loves to read. She loves, or she writes beautifully. You know, and I chalk that up to she has a completely different worldview, so words just come together differently for her. But so my daughter, Abby, so when she was 3 and I had had my 4th child, my sister came to visit, and my sister says, as Abby's sort of walking back and forth, and every time she stopped, she went, you know, like this, and then she would turn around and do that, turn around. My sister said, "Oh, did you ever think Abby could be autistic?" And I go, "Oh no, those are those kids who sit in the corner and spin, and you know, according to whatever Lifetime movie I may have seen at some point, right? You know, yes, despite being a biologist, I didn't know all the facts, and of course, being the 3rd child, I'm thinking." You know, kids are different.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, so she's different. She's got some quirks. Luckily, her father's sister's husband, brother-in-law, is one of the top pediatric neuropsychologists in the state of Illinois, where we live. So we were able to call and go, "Hey, you know what? There's this, you know, my sister suggested this. What do you think?" And he just said, "It might be wise for you to check that out," you know, and he's being completely, you know, professional, not wanting to just get in and say, "Yes, look for this," but he did give us hints on when you go, you know, point out this, this, this. I said, okay. So thus began, we got a diagnosis, and this is the 90s, early 90s. You get a diagnosis of PDD-NOS. No, it's the late 90s. PDD-NOS, pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified. And
as many autism parents call it, physician didn't decide.
Yes. So, you know, and these things were determined by ticking off boxes. After a little bit of observation and conversing with the parents. But indeed, there were things that were seemed like deficits and that needed to be addressed in expressive language. And she was a pro at that echolalia
to
repeat things. And one of our favorite, I mean, these things we look back, and even she thinks they're amusing now when we relay the stories, but we were in the movie theater watching Zorro, with Catherine Zeta-Jones and, you know, I guess Antonio Banderas, and she's maybe 4, 5, and Abby starts talking, and we say, "No talking in the movie theater," and she just starts going, "No talking in the movie theater, no talking in the movie theater," no talking, like, endlessly, so she had to go out in the hallway, know, and we have many, many pictures of, you could tell just social things just didn't click. She knew a smile meant the corners of your mouth were up, but she didn't know she could smile. So we have tons of pictures like this, you know. she pushed the sides of her mouth up because she didn't realize, and it took a long time to sort of train her that, no, you're smiling, see. And this would have been a great time to have an iPhone where we could immediately snap a photo and show. didn't have that. So, you know, there were lots of worries about how would she adapt. We learned how to deal with the school system. We learned to be creative because we knew maybe the schools couldn't provide everything she needed. Yeah. And, you know, but the things I learned, like I said with your book, it's like I learned a lot of this stuff in the book, not the history of Hans Asperger and everything, but when you're mentioning Bernard Rimland, I'm like, I know that name. And vitamins. I even ordered a little sample of the vitamins and gave for a couple days, and she got so cranky. I went, "I don't know. I don't think this is right." And then there were so many treatments that I thought, that doesn't seem right to mess around with a kid's brain like that. You know? So it was worrisome. But just for reference, this is her at
Very cute.
At 15.
That's great.
And this was just before she decided to shave her head and keep it shaved. So she's 19 now, and she loves her shaved head because it's no nonsense and no fuss, right? But now, it's funny. So we talk about smart techie people having kids on the spectrum, mm-hmm. and I guess that sort of describes us. My mm-hmm. other three children are all choosing sort of physics-based careers. She's chosen to be a Spanish language major, which I think is interesting. You know,
a lot of people with Asperger's syndrome have an affinity for language study, actually.
Yeah.
That's one of those things that kept coming up in my research.
Yeah, and that they can learn a new language without any accent.
Yeah, and, you know, mm-hmm. when you mentioned that she was a pro at echolalia, that's actually a very good example of a myth that has been debunked, which is that in the early days of behavior modification for autism, or ABA, applied behavior analysis, as it's called, the guy who invented that, Ole Ivar Lovaas, he believed that echolalia was terrible and that it was the way that the child sort of self-stimulated instead of communicating, and mm-hmm. it was a perverse misuse of language, etc. And so he actually would use electric shocks to extinguish echolalia in these brutal experiments that could only be called torture. I mean, even though he had, you know, good intentions, like many other people who've practically tortured autistic children. But what eventually came out was that echolalia is actually a distinctively autistic way of learning language.
Yeah.
And that if a child is doing echolalia, that is a very, very promising sign that they'll be able to learn language, whereas autistic children who don't do echolalia, which is like for people who are not initiated into the special vocabulary of autism, echolalia is like, you know, mom goes to the daughter and says, "Do you want a glass of water?" And the daughter says, "Want a glass of water," instead of saying, "I want a glass of water."
Right.
You know, they're like, it's like hip hop DJs sampling, you know, other songs. Like autistic people doing echolalia, you know, sample other people's language, and then can string batches of echolalia together sometimes to express their own original thoughts. There's a character in my book who spoke only in echolalia until he was 12, but no one knew it because he was so good at it that people didn't pick up on it, you know? So anyway, but it's like if he had never heard a phrase around him, he couldn't just invent it out of whole cloth. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a different method of language production. So extinguishing echolalia with electric shocks was like a worst-case scenario, really horrible. You know? Yeah. And same thing with stimming, this. You know, it's like they would give kids electric shocks for stimming. Stimming turns out to be a very effective way to soothe anxiety and to regulate energy levels. Yeah.
Yeah, my daughter famously wore a rut, a literal like 6-inch rut in the backyard because she walked. She sort of did this hop, skip, walk in a circle any chance she got. And the dog loved it because the dog could just walk along that path. They were good friends.
That's great. Joanne, could I ask you a shockingly, perhaps intrusive question?
Sure.
Have you since your daughter's diagnosis, have you thought, well, maybe this thing that I do is slightly autistic? Mm-hmm. Has that ever occurred to you?
You know, I thought of that because everybody says, oh, are you, you know, like, because parents would discover, right, afterwards, like, oh, wow. It didn't really occur to me. I would say, yes, shy and nerdy mm-hmm. when I was a girl, but I don't think I was socially inappropriate, you know, at all, or hesitant, but shy, definitely, and that didn't go away until I was pinged for modeling, which was taken as a very practical thing, not because I thought, oh, wonderful, I always wanted to model. It was sort of like, ooh, models earn money, I could use that for medical school. Okay.
Wow, that's great.
You know, it's super practical.
How old were you when you started doing modeling?
15.
Oh my God, that must have been a whole other. I mean, we can't talk about it because it's off topic. But what an experience that must have been for you.
Yeah, well, and it was exactly what I needed to come out of my shyness.
Yeah,
you know?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, it, yeah.
You know, because I think otherwise I would have walked around forever just nose in a book. You know,
right.
Well, my nose is still in a book, but now, yeah, now I'm doing science.
Certainly, plenty of characteristics that sounded very familiar. And they sounded familiar to me, too. And I thought, oh, my goodness. Yeah, so there are behavioral things that seem very familiar to me personally, but maybe toned down in some cases and not so toned down in other cases. But.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody's on the spectrum a little bit.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, that's the thing. The most subversive idea embedded in Lorna Wing's concept of the spectrum is, as she put it to me, the spectrum shades imperceptibly into eccentric normality.
Right. Yeah.
In other words, there is no behavior that only autistic people do and neurotypical people don't. Autistic
right.
people stim, neurotypical people fidget, autistic people have perseverations, neurotypical people have hobbies. It's all a matter of degree.
Well, we read all of these stories and things, and we think about it. And even before we get to the end, another question I wrote down is, what is normal?
Yeah, well, that's the thing.
It's not so easy.
Right, and my secret, subversive plan was to completely subvert and deconstruct the idea of normal by writing.
Curse you! Curse you!
I know. and you know. While we're letting it all hang out here, you know, part of that is I'm gay. And so it's like my, you know, one of the most beautiful things about me, my feelings for my husband, you know, were considered a mental disorder in the DSM.
Yep.
Until the early 1970s. And so now I'm not saying, you know, I've been accused of like Silberman equates, you know, gay rights with autism. No, it's not like that. I'm not that stupid, basically. Obviously, you know, autism is a profound and pervasive disability, and I don't believe the same can be said for homosexuality, except in the social context of disability sense, which is that homosexuality certainly was a disability before the early 1970s when it was taken out of the DSM.
Yeah.
It could really mess up your life, you know. You could end
well,
up...
Well, I suspect that I had my own perspective on many of these things you talk about because poor Joanne gets left out here, but I'm another one of those men married to a man. And,
oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
It gives us a viewpoint that is different from some other viewpoints, certainly.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, one more thing I thought of to ask about. When I was reading about the people who were using the earliest online bulletin boards and things and started to organize a neurotribe, shall we say, online, I thought, I bet I can enlist Steve to help me fight back against those irritating extroverts who go around saying, everyone spends too much time online, they need to get out and meet some real people for a change.
That's
and,
funny.
You know, and I always want to say to them, they don't understand, obviously, what a boon the internet is for introverts, and now I think for autistic people and a lot of other people who wouldn't be able to get out and meet, quote, real people, but instead have more social interaction than they've ever had possible for them before.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, one of the real gifts to my life of having written this book is that I now have a bunch of autistic friends. And at least a couple of them who I really like very much, if you saw them in public, like if we were having a coffee at a cafe or if you saw them on a bus or whatever, you would think, well, you know, this person is probably very intellectually disabled. They don't look happy. You know, they look very uncomfortable. You know, and, you know, if you saw them at a party, you'd think they wanted to jump out the window because they look so uncomfortable, you know. But when they get behind a keyboard, they are... hilarious, funny, hip, warm, swinging, full of, you know, hipster cultural references. And these are people who go through life being routinely underestimated by people. And in fact, I want to quote a quote that I really wanted to use in the book, and I could not. One of my autistic friends is named Mark Ramoser, and he is hilarious on Facebook. And he was diagnosed by Leo Kanner, one of the pioneers of autism research, who I write about in great depth in my book.
Yeah.
And what he likes to say is, when I was diagnosed, Leo Kanner told my mother that she should put me in an institution. So she put me at Yale.
The Harvard people are loving that. That's funny. Very funny. Wow, I know, Steve, I could talk to you for a very long time, just given my personal appreciation for your book. But as it goes, we've come to an hour just about. Is there anything we haven't asked you that you would like to make sure you say, especially if it's related to science or science communication?
Well, one thing that's interesting is that some people have said that, you know, I sort of focus too much on, like, science geeks or whatever. That's in part because I am one and I'm married to one, but I actually, like, there are several people in the book who are nonverbal.
No.
But because they don't talk, they don't get noticed as much by readers, which is interesting. Like, you know, I have a whole chapter on this wonderful family called the Roses, whose son Leo he's not nonverbal, but he's very limited expressive vocabulary. And it's as if people, like, don't notice him. And that's happening in the larger culture all the time. You know, like, nonverbal people often get overlooked. And so I just want to say, like, pay attention to some of the characters in my book who don't say much, because there's a lot going on with them, too.
That's a really good point. And that's, you know... Oh, it's amazing. These are some of the things I've learned the hard way, I would say, but on a beautiful journey with my daughter. But as I said, your book would have been a tremendous asset. It's not a how-to book, but it would have been this lovely addition to, you know, starting roadmap for all
Thank
of it.
You. Thank and, you. And if I can add a plug for another excellent book that came out, it's almost like a sister book to mine, this book, Uniquely Human by Barry Prezant.
Ah.
It came out just like a week or two before my book, and we just met the other day. We have both marveled over the fact that the two books play really well together.
Okay.
And for parents, I would say that I would almost recommend that they read Uniquely Human first or something, but Uniquely Human is, well, my book, Neurotribes, is the history.
Yes.
And then Uniquely Human is like, what am I going to do with my kid? How should I look at my kid? And Uniquely Human is that book. So
that's a good resource, Joanne. We'll write it below the YouTube video when this gets archived. You know, we'll link to yours. We'll link to that one as well. And so, you know, when I was dealing with Abby, most of the books out were. You know, from autistic people who, you know, were telling their stories, and you know, Donna Williams' story is just, Jeff, you want to read a good book, this Nobody Nowhere will leave you in a heap on the floor going, oh, God.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but it's so, you know, well written. And, you know, and of course we've had Temple Grandin on our show.
Yeah, she's amazing.
She changed completely. You know, there were moments of despair I had with my daughter. What would she ever be able to do? What are her capacities? Mm. And Temple was out there saying, they have gifts. We have gifts.
Yeah.
One
widespread myth that is long overdue for debunking is that people say, only savants have these gifts, or only quote-unquote high-functioning autistic people have these gifts. That's actually not true. Even autistic people with intellectual disability can have some really astonishing gifts. So don't underestimate autistic people, because it's been done for 70 years, and it's time to move on and regard them with respect.
There you go.
You're doing a great, great service here, Steve.
Thank you. I appreciate it
very much. And so I'll ask, maybe a little early, and you may be too much in the whirl of the press afterwards. You think you got another book in you?
Yeah, don't ask me that yet. I almost killed myself writing this one, I'll tell you. You know, really, I was working for 80 hours a week for 5 years. And there's nothing that I would rather do less than continue to sit in this chair. So I'm going to need, like, some swimming or something, you know, now for a while. Yeah.
Like 3 years of swimming, yeah, exactly. And then you can write a book, What I Learned in Three Years of Swimming.
Exactly. I also want to tackle a more, a less gnarly subject than autism, so maybe kittens next time.
Steve Silverman's next book, Kittens.
Well, thank you so much, Joanne and Jeff.
Thank
it's been
you.
Really a pleasure to be here.
Steve, we are so happy. Very delightful. Exactly. You're a wonderful guest, a wonderful author, and I hope, you know, if you, even if you don't know anybody on the autistic spectrum, which I find hard to believe because they're all over. I recommend
anybody
this book because it's just a marvelously written book on the New York Times bestseller list. So, you know, that's not too bad at all. And so feel free to pick that up and read it. It's 500 pages, but it was just one of those books I just read straight through. You know, I don't think I read it in one sitting, but I read straight through. Thank you to everybody who joined us today for this discussion. And Jeff, as always, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Always
my pleasure,
a pleasure.
Joanne and Steve, thanks very much.
Right.
Thanks so much, guys. Yeah, take care.
All right.
See you soon.
All right. Bye.
Bye.